As a subcommittee, this is the Ways and Means Sub on Education, and we'll continue with the Department of Education and the Office of Student Services. Chris. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Durham, Director of Management Services at the Department of Education. Today, we're proceeding through the offices of the department with the Office of Student Services. If I could direct your attention to the blue book, the tab entitled Student Services, which is on page 55, just as a starting point for today's presentation. 55 has the organization chart that shows where Student Services fits into the organization. And then on page 56 is a summary of the budget that I'd like to go through because there are quite a few important items to highlight for you. First of all, in Department Operations for Student Services, there's about almost $6 million general funds, some other funds, and $8.4 million of federal. Then we have a program option package, which you've heard two packages before. We placed them in this office's budget for presentation. You've heard yesterday and the day before about the dropout prevention recovery in number 104 low-performing schools and the companion package for the dropout down in grant and aid package 303 for the $2.7 million dropout and prevention. Also of highlight is the in the grant and aid is the central package number 20, which is the phase-in of the Oregon pre-kindergarten, which was to maintain our current service level of 50% into this next biennium, and that's a $10.4 million package, which is in the governor's budget as an essential package and part of the current service level. Then we have a new program option package, number 301, the Oregon pre-kindergarten of $5.9 million, which you'll hear about today. And that is to take the Oregon pre-kindergarten program to serving eligibles up to approximately 60% of those eligible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Trump.
With regard to that, federal government apparently spending more money in education. Are they spending more on Head Start so that we can make any adjustments in our spending there? I certainly want us to get to 60% or even better, but what are the feds doing?
Mr. Chair, if I could defer that question for just a moment with Anita McClanahan, we'll go through a presentation on pre-kindergarten and address that.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Continuing on the grant and aid programs, this office is heavily funded with federal categorical programs such as the Title I low income, for $154 million approximately, Title I migrant for $27.5 million, emergency immigrant $2.8 million, and the largest, the child nutrition program, which you will hear about today, and various other federal programs of significance. There's a new program this year that's we have not received the grant, but we're expecting to, and it's entitled a school renovation towards the bottom of the page. We're expecting a revenue of about $19 million, and the purpose is to target a limited number of schools for renovation. It is not a maintenance, but of course statewide, that isn't very many dollars to do much in renovation, and it will be a competitive grant. Schools will compete for those dollars. In class size reduction, just above that, we received a significant increase over the prior biennium, about $6 to $7 million. The column that is offered,
yes. Does that $31 million rec include the $6 to $7 million?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does.
Okay. And under this major heading here, none of these grant need programs were included in the governor's original budget or revised budget.
Mr. Chair, that they were included, although I was just going to say we have new estimates on what the revenues will be, which are higher in many cases than what are in the governor's budget. So the figure at the bottom for this program, we're expecting approximately a $36.5 million increase in these programs over what's in the governor's budget. so I wanted to portray what we really think the revenue will be rather than what it was in December.
When you are able to include these federal funds, I mean, are they money in the bank, or how sure are you that we're going to get those funds?
Mr. Chair, we are absolutely certain on the first year of the biennium. We have been conservative in estimating the second year by taking approximately that same level and adding a small inflationary figure. From talk we've heard from what the President is desirous, it is likely that the revenues will be greater the second year, and we would no doubt we would need to come back for additional limitation if that were to occur.
Okay, and so we can do that with a budget note and you can come to the emergency board for the second?
Mr. Chair, yes, we can come to the emergency board.
Okay. Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are the majority or what portion of these funds are so categorical that they cannot replace general fund dollars or supplant those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, they all have the requirement of non-supplanting. With that, I would like to introduce Merced Flores, Associate Superintendent for the office, to give you a discussion of the entire office.
Thank you, Chris. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Merced Flores, Associate Superintendent for the Office of Student Services at the Department of Education. The Office of Student Services, as Chris mentioned, provides services and funding from about 25 state and federal programs. We basically lay the foundation for about, well, for the social, academic, personal, and nutritional needs of children across the state. From this office, we also provide training, program development, evaluation, monitoring, and assistance to school districts, ESDs, and other cooperating agencies. As we administer so many programs, we basically develop our program under five different premises. First, we know that these dollars must go to kids or students who are educationally challenged and have many factors such as poverty, are linguistically diverse, many times are mobile, and sometimes kids that really need some additional help. And our programs are designed to decrease or close the achievement gap, in many cases, in our schools. Also, one of the things, the way that we do this and to close the academic gap is that our dollars are to supplement and not to supplant, or never to replace dollars that are provided at the school district level. As we all know, the monies are to be provided for supplemental purposes as the state is responsible for the mainstream education of our kids. The federal role is to provide additional resources in order for students to be able to have additional services, in many cases to be able to receive the extra help that they might need, whether it be extended day services, whether it be tutoring, or any other type of programs that might help them get to the level. The next role is basically to make sure that we use our federal funds in order to help kids achieve. And many times in the past, we've had programs where we've had our silo programs, and we said, who, what, and how do we provide you services? Now we basically say, we must provide results. And so the federal government has said, if you take these dollars, you must be able to look at the resources that you have at the state level, combine them with your federal resources, and provide the best possible results. Now, in the last 5 years, since the last 6 years, since 1994 reauthorization of the Elementary Secondary Act, we've been helping schools achieve and come out of that low status level. Now, when we talk about a report card system where we look at our low-performing schools, we're actually helping schools get up to that satisfactory level, and we've been doing that with some of our federal funds. We now know that we have a lot more schools that do not fit this category, and we need additional help. But actually, we've started this already and provide some additional help that school districts have needed. Also, we've looked at flexibility and the flexibility to be able to use these dollars. As you know, we were the first EdFlex state back in 1994, 95, I believe it was, that was the time that our great U.S. Senator Mark Hatfield helped us put together that EdFlex bill. Since that time, we are still an EdFlex state and have been able to use our federal dollars, combine them with our state dollars to provide better results. One of the things that's going to be happening here pretty soon is that we will reauthorize the new federal dollars, or reauthorization will come pretty close to the start of our summer. And what will, this allows, the reauthorization allows our Congress and our President to decide how to best use the dollars. And I know that many of you have heard of the changes that the Bush administration is conducting at the present time. But we will see that some of the very same types of requirements will be required, actually, of every state who receives, that receives these dollars. And we will talk about targeting funds for high-needs children. We'll also talk about accountability, to increase that accountability more than we ever have in the past. And also, we will ensure that all children have the opportunity to attain the highest standards. So our office, the Office of Student Services, has combined with various other offices at the Department of Education. In fact, we do a great job. And I would have to commend our staff and the Department of Education that does a little bit more than other states in combining braiding dollars for better resources, actually using the resources for better services across the state. One of our biggest general fund programs is the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, and we'll have Anita McClanahan talk about this program in a few minutes. But we also have the largest federal education program, which is our Title I-A basic program. And this is the infamous Title I program that we hear about all the time. And I'll have Dr. Rick Latour talk about this program in a few minutes. But also our largest non-education program that is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture is our school nutrition program. That program supplements the types of services, the support services our students need to carry on in their educational life. And I will have Dr. Joyce Doherty talk about that program in a few minutes. I will also allow some time to talk about the, there was, I believe, a budget note during this last session regarding gun safety expulsions, and also I believe there was a question yesterday about the last session's Senate Bill 103, and I'll talk a little bit about that program also. But I do want to say that federal programs have always been a good resource for us. They have been able to provide the supplemental help that we've needed to combine our resources in order for us to provide good quality services across the state. Back in 1994, when the reauthorization took place, we were one of the first states to look at what we had and combined our resources. We braided our resources and also services to students, and we made things happen for local level. I think we were very courageous at that time to say, how can we use these dollars to better serve kids? And a lot of other states followed our lead and saw that it could be done, and we have since then produced better results. At this time, I'd like to have Anita McClanahan talk about the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program. As you know, this is modeled after our federal Head Start program. It provides comprehensive education, health, and social services to three and four-year-olds and also their families. At the present time, we are serving nearly 9,000 students, which is about 50% of our eligible children. And again, this is a very collaborative project. We've been working with our federal and state partners in making services available, and I believe that we have one of our best programs. Now, there might be some questions about the different types of federal programs and federal programs that provide Head Start dollars, and Anita might be able to answer, well, will be able to answer those questions, I'm sure. But I believe that because we run so many different programs out of this office, I also, and I probably want to say this out public, we have about 50 staff members in this office that really do a tremendous job. And when you have to juggle a number of federal programs and state programs, you have to look at all the regulations, all the different concerns that there are about handling dollars. And I think we're probably the best around. So hopefully we'll be able to answer your questions today. But I'll turn it over to Anita McClanahan.
Thank you, Merced. For the record, I'm Anita McClanahan, Director of Early Childhood Programs from the Department of Ed. And I do know that you have several questions, and I want to answer those questions. And if it would please the chair and the members of the committee, I would like to do an overview of the Oregon Head Start pre-program and then go on with the questions related to the federal program and other questions that I know have been asked by the committee in previous hearings. I prepared for you a packet that's in a green folder And my presentation will actually follow the information that is in your packet that looks like this. I would hope to cover first just a very brief history of Oregon Head Start for Kindergarten. I want to discuss our funding sources and our investment practices, discuss briefly the percentage of children served, review for you the population that we actually serve within this program, and then proudly present to you the child outcomes that we are able to report on and discuss our next steps, which will also include answers for your questions. So if you would like to open to the first page of the resource packet, I'm certain several of you on the committee do remember that it was 13 years ago that we made a promise in Oregon to our most vulnerable children, and our promise was to support their families and the child with comprehensive services, and we dedicated ourselves to do this in the form of the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program, adopted after the Head Start model, which means that we have, as a state, adopted all of the performance requirements that are required within the federal Head Start program. The goal of this program is to prepare children to enter school comparable to their age mates or their peer group, and to help families break their cycle of poverty. And as I was preparing this presentation, I found it quite exciting to think that since 13 years ago, 1987, more than 80,000 children have been served in the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten program. And we started in 1988 by serving only 5% of the eligible population. We currently are serving 50%. And as Merced indicated, that's close to 9,000 children. The sad part of our story is that there are still 9,000 children that are unserved, and that's one of the things that we will discuss as we go on this afternoon. If you move to the next page, there's a map for you which indicates that we actually have two funding streams in our state. We have the Oregon funds and we have the federal funds, and those funds feed into one single program that we identify as Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten. We are unique in all of the nation in the fact that we truly have combined federal and state dollars to serve the poorest children in our families in a Head Start program. There's not another state in the country that does the service such as Oregon. We're able to do this because our state adopted the federal performance standards. We are identical to the federal Head Start program. So our funds come together and they are dispersed across 36 counties, clear across the state. We have approximately 440 sites and we're serving, as we mentioned earlier, about 9,000 children. The next page gives you a graph of how we spend the funds. The program dollars are distributed across three major component areas, and those areas are identified for you in the graph as health services, family services, and child services. And I'd like to remind you again that this is a comprehensive child-family program. It's a program that connects and links the child within the context of the family to obtain the best results for the children as they enter our public school system. You can see that our average cost per child in the last biennium was $7,312. And you can see how those dollars are distributed across the three major component areas. And it's very clear that the bulk of those funds are deposited into the child services area. And that's the component area that provides the comprehensive education. It also must pay for all of the transportation costs and the facilities costs, and then support of those children that are in our program who are placed there because of disabilities.
Excuse me, on the disabilities part there, do you get any special ed money from any other government allocation?
We do not receive special ed money directly, Chair Hartung. The monies follow the child. The child does receive extraordinary disability services within the program if they need those services, but we do not receive monies from disability services.
Thank you.
I would like to highlight for you the families that we are serving, and if you turn to the next part of the report, I'm not going to go through every page of this, but on this part of the report, we talk about the child family characteristics. And I think it's critical for us to remember that the population we are serving are the poorest families in the state of Oregon. They qualify to be in this program, or they are considered eligible to be served in the program based on federal poverty income guidelines. And a family of four currently can earn no more than $17,050 to qualify for the program. I'd like to highlight for you the fact that 67% of our families through the last 3 years have earned less than $12,000 a year. That has been their base income, 67%. And I can give you that same statistic. 67% of these families are either employed part-time or full-time, and they're earning only $12,000 approximately in a year. Children to qualify for free lunch, their families can earn $22,165 a year. Or if a child is on a family of four and a child is on the reduced lunch program, their families can earn $31,500 a year. So you can see by those statistics that we are serving the lowest income, the highest need children in the state through our program of Head Start.
Sure. Senator Schroeder.
Are the 9,000 families that you're not serving, are those families of similar income background?
Chair Hartung, Senator Tro, they are. Our programs tell us currently that they have huge waiting lists, and I like to use as one of my most current examples is in the Mount Hood Community College program. They have actually verified eligibility for over 400 families that they are not able to serve. And when I say verify, that means that their income is at the federal poverty level. And yes, when we take the count that says there are 9,000 eligible children, those children are at the same poverty level.
Okay. And do they live differently than the 9,000 persons who are served in different parts of the state, or are we just underserving people all over the state without any particular area being more underserved than another?
Chair Hartung and Senator Tro, we have made a very concentrated effort to serve equally across the state. So the unserved population is equally distributed across the state. We've made a conscious choice about how we've deposited and distributed the funds so that everyone is at about the same percentage level. So every county is fairly close to a 50% service level.
I didn't realize that.
Yes, we've done that very consciously. I would just like also to highlight for you that when we did the statistical analysis, what we did note, and this would be on the bottom of page 5, you can see that in the graph, that there is a decline in employment. And I only highlight that because I believe that we're seeing that across the board within our state, and it's certainly affecting the population that we're serving in this program. On page 6, the significant thing that I would like to point out to you is that if we look at the graph, there's a decline in employment, that families are not able to find employment. And when we...
Means there are more...
Families not working, yes.
Not earning.
And not earning. That's correct, Senator Trump. Another significant increase that we have found in our statistical analysis is that there are more families who are in a high need of education, basically around literacy or some form of employment training that would allow them to enter back into the workforce and be able to earn a living wage for their family. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a quick question, Anita, in regard to the number of students and the number of kids that are being served and the number of families. If approximately 9,000 kids are being served, are there multiple children in those families, or do you have the number of families that are actually being served?
Chair Hartung and Representative Hobson, I don't have that right on the tip of my tongue, but I can find you. There, in most cases, there, the number of children that are multiple children from a single family are not frequent.
The age.
Yes, it's the age. Like, they, typically we're serving, the highest percentage that we're serving are four-year-olds, and it's rare that there would be a three-year-old sibling within the program. I'm not saying it doesn't occur. I do know it does occur, but it's not the common trend. And I can find for you the exact number of families, if you would like that, and I'll make a note for that. If we could look at the chart on page 7, what I wanted to point out, because the question has come up about the ethnicity of the families and are we serving an appropriate number of non-English speaking children, and we did a review of this and discovered that the population that we serve represents the ethnicity of the local communities. And so the highest ethnicity group that we have currently growing within our state, as we're all aware, is the Hispanic population. And we're actually serving a higher Hispanic population than what the statewide average of Hispanics are. And so I wanted to point that out because the question has been brought up to our attention, and wanted to verify for you that we are serving multicultural, we are definitely meeting the needs of our diverse communities and our diverse populations. But I also would like to remind you that this isn't a program that is specified for migrant children or Hispanic children. It's specified for children who live in poverty, and that goes across all cultures and all ethnic groups. On page 8, the only highlight I would like to make for you is I would like to point out the consistency across the 3 years in the number of children that we serve who are identified as suffering from child abuse and neglect. And we were quite surprised when we did this analysis to find that within the last 3 years, that statistic has remained stable, that there's 19% of the children that we're serving are identified as suffering from some form of child abuse or neglect. It's an alarming statistic to me, and it's one that I hope that we can maybe do something about. The last thing that I would like to just point out for you is on page 9, and that's that we do serve as a placement site for children who are identified as having special education needs. And the law requires that we serve 10%, or 10% of the population we serve should be children with disabilities, that we reserve 10% of our sites or slots for children with disabilities so our services can be a placement site for them. And you can see by our statistics that our programs serve well above that, that we have been between, you can see clearly it's 16% for 1999-2000 are children that are placed there with some form of identified special need. And you can also see from the graph that the most commonly identified need and why Head Start would be an appropriate placement for these children is speech and language. And the programs are rich in language development, and it's a very, very appropriate site for them. And as well as the regular kinds of literacy and language development that they get in the program, they do receive special services from speech pathologists if that is on the child's individualized special education plan. And so they receive multiple kinds of service within the program.
Anita, and it was like in your cover, page 1, we call it the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten. And then, like on page 10, Head Start students, we're talking about the same population.
We are talking about the same children. And I'm moving to page 10 now, Chair Hartung. Thank you very much. You know,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Anita, do the Head Start programs identify the handicapped children, or are they referred from another agency like an ESD as a handicapped early?
Chair Hartung and Representative Hobson, it happens both ways. We receive children who are referred in who have been identified to special education, child find, or other ways that maybe it's been from birth the child has been identified, and they then could be referred. And then we also, as the children are screened and assessed within the program, there are also children, and that accounts for part of the reason our population in identified special needs is higher, because sometimes because the child does not come in identified as a special education student, but are identified within the program during the course of their time with us. Now, I'm very pleased to present to you page 10. I feel very excited about this because when Oregon did the readiness survey in November of this past year, of the year 2000, we asked a critical question related to children who attended Head Start programs, and we wanted to know how these children were measuring up as to other children entering the public school system, and were they ready for the kindergarten environment and for their next steps in on their educational journey. And it was very exciting to analyze the data and find that in three critical dimensions, we actually look at six dimensions of readiness, and the most critical dimensions are the ones highlighted: physical well-being, the child's ability to use language, and the child's approach to learning. And in these three critical dimensions, the Head Start children scored very, very, very well, as you can see. I believe that our goal of having children prepared comparable to their age mates is truly being met. You can see by the chart at the bottom of the page where the state average is and then the average score of the Head Start children. And what's so exciting about this is to recognize from where the Head Start child began their journey. And I've been in several homes on home visits with families, with teaching staff going into the homes of Head Start children, where there are no books in the home. There are no writing tools. There's no furniture in many of these homes. They're very, very poor families. And when I see children achieving as close to the state average as this, I find that very exciting, and I'm very pleased to be able to share that with you. Then I'd like you to look on page 11.
The chart at the bottom, Head Start, 91% on the first item there. And so that's 9,000, the population of 9,000 students, because that's enrollment of Head Start now. Is that correct?
This percentage represents the percentage of the overall percentage of the children who were evaluated by kindergarten teachers as meeting physical well-being as a criteria.
After they were enrolled in?
After they were enrolled in kindergarten, when they went to kindergarten.
Oh. Okay.
At Chair Hartung. This is.
So, where do you get the state average figure?
The state average figure, survey evaluated, there was an 84% return on the survey, Chair Hartung, and we evaluated about 18,800 kindergarten children.
Five-year-olds,
kindergarten children. These are children that are entering the public kindergarten program.
Okay.
And so we were evaluating the public kindergarten children, and these are children who were in the public kindergarten who had a Head Start experience.
Oh, okay. Oh, so the state average includes kids
yes.
that have had the Head Start experience.
The state average would include those children.
Okay, thank you. Justin, Senator Cho.
The language usage, when we have so many children now who come from families where another language other than English is used, how are we coping with those children in the pre-kindergarten programs, and are we measuring language use in at home language rather than in English, or how are we doing that?
Chair Hartung and Senator Cho, that's a very excellent question. Within our Head Start programs, we have the good fortune of when children do not speak English, and basically the majority of our non-English speaking children are children who are Spanish speaking currently, although in the Portland area we do have some other languages, and there are some other issues in trying to get appropriate language instruction for these children. But as you know, Head Start also utilizes a large volunteer corps, and we've been able to have translators for the children in all areas. And for us, that's a critical piece to the learning development of very young children. And when we ask the kindergarten teachers to assess the language uses of the children, we ask them to do that in the child's primary language. So if the child's primary language was Spanish, their assessment would have been in their primary language, because it gives us critical information. If the child can communicate in their language, then we know they have the capacity for learning in many different kinds of ways. And then getting them to learn English is another step for us.
We know that many of the children that come from Mexico, for instance, children that come from Mexico don't know Spanish very well. Many of them come from an Indian background with an Indian language. How do we cope with that?
Sometimes that's, Chair Hartung and Senator Trove, sometimes that's very challenging. And I have to say, I'm not going to say that we're perfect and that we are able to assist every single family as deeply as we would like to. But I can say with a great measure of confidence that every effort is made to assist that family. And we get aunts and uncles and cousins. We use exchange students. We try to find whoever can help us with those children.
Wonderful. That's great. Thank you.
Oh, yes. Excuse me. Merced also has a response.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trull, we also received dollars. Actually, our Department of Education did not receive these dollars, but we also received dollars from the Health and Human Services Office to our Migrant Head Start programs. These programs are able to help a few of these children who have those other languages in learning a native language. In some cases, there might be Spanish instruction, there might be English instruction, but the goal is to encourage these students to become English fluent. And so it's very interesting how sometimes these programs will find the ways to help kids develop the language. It's in a recent trip, since, you know, we have this partnership with several Mexican states, we went to the state of Oaxaca and found that many of the Indian groups, the Mixtecos, and quite a few of the other language groups were coming to one location to learn Spanish. And then to make that transition to the city, to Mexico City, and then eventually to learn other languages. But the main language that they were trying to learn was English, to be able to make it here in the United States. So it is a challenging effort for many different programs, especially our programs, the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten programs, and also those Migrant Head Start programs that are separate from the dollars that we receive. And we have some excellent programs across the state. I was fortunate to serve on their board of directors. And but again, it is very challenging when you have various language groups. And of course, in Portland, it's even challenging.
Exciting to hear about your efforts, though. Yes. Sounds great.
Thank you.
That is a great effort. I'm wondering, like in the Beaverton District, they now have up to 60 different languages and dialects. And how do you find people to, you know, start with these pre-kindergarten Head Start people with that clientele?
Mr. Chair, I believe that one of the things that Anita mentioned, or one of the ways that Anita mentioned, is that sometimes we need to use uncles, aunts, folks that speak the language to help make that transition. And one of the most effective ways of helping kids make that transition is that native language instruction or the translation or interpretation. Many times it's very difficult for us to try and find certified staff or instructional staff that might be able to help us. And many times, some of our programs, especially with the Head Start programs, don't pay the very top dollar. And so we rely on help, volunteers, a number of folks, so retired people, university students, but various people that will help make that transition. And it has been very challenging. I know that Beaverton is growing like crazy, and the needs are very great in that metropolitan.
Well, and I'm glad to hear you say how you are approaching it, and in the long run that will add to the strength of the program to bring in the community and the parents like that. So thank you for doing what you're doing there.
Thank you.
Chair Hartung and members of the committee, when I was school principal on the coast in Oregon, we had a group of Hispanic, about three families that moved into our community, and we had a Head Start site at the building where I was principal. And We were not equipped in that community to speak Spanish. We didn't have Spanish-speaking teachers. We didn't have Spanish-speaking anyone within the district, actually. And at the time, there were some exchange students at the high school that were Spanish-speaking. And though the dialect was somewhat different, they were able to communicate with the children and help us communicate with the family. That was the most critical thing, was that link with the parents, so that the parents felt their children were in a secure place. So I find that sort of creativity happening across our state. Teachers and program directors are so aware of this high need to be able to speak with the children and with the families, the parents of these children, that they're seeking out the resources wherever we can find them. And it seems that people are quite willing to come in and be a volunteer and help us in that effort. So,
thank you. Representative Schrader.
Some questions, if I may. I assume that the Head Start Pre-K program in the state of Oregon is all one seamless program, not two different programs.
Chair Hartung and Representative Schrader, you are absolutely, totally 100% accurate. Doesn't that feel good? Almost like an A.
Does that mean yes?
I think it's a yes.
Another question. What type of, this is a basic question, I apologize for being in and out. I have to go out again. What services are actually provided in the booklet here, like on page 6, talk about needed education, literacy, employment training, counseling, mental health, emergency. Is that the services that these families get from the program?
The program is, excuse me, Chair Hartung and Representative Schrader, the services are comprehensive and they are inclusive of all of the things that you mentioned. The families, the children are assessed first, of course, for their educational needs. And then families also have the opportunity for goal setting and for their needs to be assessed. And then there is a great deal of collaboration across community programs to ensure that what the families need to meet their goals, that they can access those through other community resources. It's not that Head Start provides everything, but they are the point of assistance to the family. They're the relationship builder and help the families that want to have that kind of service to move into other areas for their needs.
Yes, follow up.
Then the question I guess I'd ask is, how is it different if their primary function through this is to assess the people's different needs, get them into the correct educational assistance or mentoring or whatever, or mental health assessment, help the families? How is that different than, say, Healthy Start?
Chair Hartung and Representative Schrader, it's an extremely different program than Healthy Start. Healthy Start is for families with first births, and they do first an initial assessment of the child, and then they also will assess the families for other risk factors and help them get into the appropriate services. Head Start basically is a child education program, but you cannot educate young children outside the context of their family. And because we are serving the very poorest and the neediest of families, we try to help those families in order for them to be able to help their children. And so our primary goal is the education of the child and preparing the child for school.
So Head Start doesn't just do the assessments. They also have teachers or professionals that teach these children techniques to succeed when they go to a public or private or whatever school. Is that correct?
Chair Hartung and Representative Schrader, yes. It's an educational program. It's a preschool program with curriculum and things that children learn, yes.
This last one, if I may. That's helpful. It'd be interesting to see the breakout of the amount of services that are into assessment and then those that go to actually, you know, the training of the family and the student, the young student, to succeed. That would, because we also have several others. You know, the governor's got several initiatives, and the goal is to make sure those first birth families may also qualify for this. So to the extent we don't want Healthy Start to have to duplicate precious resources, duplicate what you're already doing, so that coordination is just so important. So it'd be interesting to see the breakout of what assessments you do and how we're going to be working with Healthy Start or the rollout of whatever program comes out of the legislature to avoid the duplication so we can maximize our resources.
Chair Hartung and Representative Schrader, I would like to just let you know that currently in communities that are doing the planning for the types of things that are being rolled out with Senate Bill 555 in the State Commission around early childhood issues, the early childhood services of supports, that on every single early childhood committee in every county, there is representation from Head Start. And currently, across our counties, Head Start is at the table for all of this type of community, kind of coordinated comprehensive planning to avoid the very things that you are saying, that there will not be duplication, but rather that there is a continuous or a continuum of supports for those families.
Thanks.
And our focus is the child.
Sure.
Did I understand you to say that Healthy Start, the youngsters age 0 to 3, is that the area that that covers?
Chair Hartung, yes, it is. They start with first birth families, and they typically now have been serving children 0 to 3, yes.
Okay, and first birth families, in other words, this same family that had a Healthy Start youngster can't have another one because that's the second birth of the family?
That's the general concept, but sometimes a family does stay in the program through up and maybe will have more than one child. They may have a second birth, or they may even have a third birth. And if it's a really high-risk family, they're piped into other services for that family.
Can we identify in the governor's budget that part that is Healthy Start and Head Start? It's separated, isn't it?
Because Chair Hartung, yes.
Okay.
They are separate.
Because I share Representative Schrader's concern. Well, our biggest effort right now with the Secretary of Education, Rod Page, is to get 100% funding of Head Start, not just the 60%. And so we have to be able to really demonstrate that there's no overlap and that our Healthy Start is complementary and effective and all that. So be sure you keep us up to speed on how we're doing in that area.
Thank you, Chair Hartung, and we will. We're working very closely with the folks that are working on the Oregon Children's Plan, and our office is very involved with that. And we definitely are aware of the issues that you have brought to my attention again, and we will keep you apprised of those things.
Senator Trill.
I was just going to say that this is a very encouraging conversation because I do think that we want to have those adequate programs. One of the reasons why it really does make sense to do what the chair suggested, and that's to get this program funded 100% so we can pick up all the kids that really qualify for this. So we then have confidence that if we're providing services through this program, that all the eligible kids are getting them. But even so, since there is restraint around who can qualify based on income, and we still have a lot of kids that need to be covered outside of those income restraints. So I don't think that we can think we're getting all the kids when we do it this way.
No, you're absolutely right, Senator, because you know we have all kinds of evidence about children that come from a higher socioeconomic level might need help as much as from the poor, and we don't have the resources to do them all, but we have to be aware of that.
Different kind of, you know. Often they can afford pre-kindergarten kinds of programs, but then they always don't get them.
Exactly. Yes, continue, please.
Chair Hartung and Senator Trill, I appreciate your compassion for wanting to serve all of the children, and I also appreciate your concern regarding our need to address serving the lowest income families first with our limited resources. Mm-hmm. That must be our first approach with our limited resources. If we would look at page 10, we really do believe that we're setting our Head Start children on the right steps towards their future. And we can identify that Oregon Head Start pre-kindergarten children are ready for school. They recognize alphabet letters and words. They can write letters. Mostly they'll write their names and other familiar words. One of their most favorite words to write is, words, I should say, I love you. They love to write those words, and we love to get those messages. They also are able to identify that they have comprehension that sets them up for a predisposition to early reading. They show familiarity with books. They understand that print carries a message. They can count and solve simple number problems, and they are demonstrating social-emotional competence, a critical readiness area that we want all of our children to come into school being prepared to do. The last page that I'd like to discuss with you is our kind of long-range plan, what we hope to do for the future, and this is where I'll discuss also what we know about the federal funding that will be coming into our state. The long-range plan, of course, Chris has already mentioned that we are intending to maintain the current service level, the 50% level that we've reached, and that we need the additional $10 million to roll those children in that we added in this last biennium. And then our plan for expansion is to roll up at least to 60%, and we have a request for the budget to be a $5.9 million that was identified in the governor's budget, and for which we have a plan in order to add about 1,880 children is what Oregon needs to add to get us to the 60% service level. And the only way we'll be able to do that with $5.9 million is in the same manner in which we did the expansion this year, which was to add the children during the last half of the biennium. And then we also have our next steps, the considerations around the questions that you've been asking about serving more children. We also feel a high need to be able to do that. And we're trying to see ways that we can maximize the dollars that we do have, and are there ways that we can add additional children with the funds that we have. And so the steps that we're planning is that we must work in very close partnership with the Regional 10 Federal Office, and we have plans for that already being formed. We together want to review all of our program costs. We want to look for ways to maximize the state and federal dollars, and we want to review across the state all of the child-adult ratios within the classrooms. We did a fairly comprehensive study earlier this year, and we recognized that our programs are meeting the maximum required ratios, except for maybe three or four sites. And the three or four sites that do not have the maximum class size have related to us it's because of the required facility space, that there's a performance standard that says how much space you have to have per number of children. And some of our sites are very limited on facilities, and they can't add the children because of that. But we're still not satisfied. So we're going to go back, and we're going to do a very comprehensive look at that. We also want to see, are there any ways that we can have our programs link with larger entities to bring down the money costs that they are exhibiting for their benefit packages, for their staffing? Perhaps if there was some sort of a collaborative that they could participate in, that might help bring their costs down. And then we also want to see what other sources there are out there. Are there other funding sources that we could call upon? The question was asked about the federal resources that we're anticipating, and I know Senator Tro, you started with that question earlier this afternoon. And what I can tell you is what we know from the federal office right now is that $2.5 million have been targeted for the state of Oregon for expansion of Head Start. But that money has very tight strings attached to it. That $2.5 million programs must provide full day, full year services. And the children that are in these programs must be new children. They can't be children that we currently serve. We have to add children. And the funding for the full day, full year services is not funded 100% by the federal program. They must reach out to the child care community, and they must try to find child care resource dollars that these families would be entitled to, either through employment-related child care dollars or other kinds of child care funds that these families may be eligible to receive. We have some models of this in our state right now, but it's been very difficult to maintain the child care resource dollars in order to maintain the full year services. So what I'm just alerting you to is that there is an intent that Oregon could receive those dollars. Programs must have their grants in by June 1st. We will not know before September who has been awarded or how many slots will have been awarded. And with that amount of money, we anticipate at the very most that we could probably add between 300 and 340 children. So it still wouldn't bring us up to the 60% targeted level that we would like to reach in our expansion proposal. Do you have any further questions?
Senator Trum.
I've heard some concerns. Most people are really so praiseful of this program that it's rare you hear a concern. But some of the concerns come from people who are involved in program, teaching the program, and they're a little fearful that somehow or other, as we strive to get more dollars and to stretch dollars, that we lower the quality of the program. And so some people are concerned about that. And I've heard it, and I really don't know much more than maybe just kind of vague impression that the federal government may want to do different things with their program, and that those may change and if we're tied to their program, it may mm-hmm. change the thrust of our program, and I'm not sure we want to go in that direction.
Chair Hartungan, Senator Trow, I would like to address your first concern regarding the quality of the program. The state of Oregon is renowned for the quality of its Head Start programs. And that's not to say that every program is perfect or that there isn't a flaw here or there, but the overall quality in the state of Oregon is considered to be one of the highest in the nation. And that is something that we can hang our hats on and be very, very proud about. I also believe that the Head Start Association within our state, the Department of Education within our state, will not stand by and allow quality to decrease. It's probably the one thing that we cry out about the most, is that what research supports is that if you want the outcomes that we want, it can only be sustained in the highest quality type of program. And quality is defined by the types of teaching staff that you have, by the qualifications of the people that are working there, by appropriate child-staff ratio, by appropriate facilities and materials. And so we're very, very aware of those issues. And as long as I get to wear this hat, you know you have a strong guardian for the children of this state. Did you have another question? No, I kind of got off.
What sort of federal changes?
Yes, I can respond to that. Chair Hartung and Senator Trow, it's all rumors so far. And we probably all know the same rumors. And the rumor, of course, is that our current president would like to have the Head Start program moved from the Health and Human Services to the Department of Education and make Head Start a reading program. And that's not too clearly defined what that would mean. But again, I think there are far too many wonderful early childhood advocates, people much smarter than I at the national level, that will cry out with loud voices about doing appropriate things for our very, very young children. And our teachers now, the Head Start requirement is that teachers are certified by the year 2004. 50% of all the teachers in Head Start are to have a bachelor's degree. And that's part of the thing that's been pushing the cost of Head Start up, is because the federal office has provided additional funds so that we can have the trained workforce, so that we have appropriate staff retention. And with all of those things, you have increased quality. So, and as far as the rumors, we can't do anything about those until something actually gets down on paper. So, except hear and be aware.
Thank you. Continue.
A couple of other questions that were asked, I believe Representative Schrader asked a question about the fade-out effect, and he's not here to hear the answer to that question, but it will be recorded, and I'm sure you will share the information with him. There's been a considerable amount of research done around Head Start, and we often hear the question, well, by fifth grade it doesn't make any difference, or by eighth grade it doesn't make any difference. And I want to remind us that the essential purpose of Head Start is not to prepare the child for eighth grade or for fifth grade. The purpose for Head Start is to prepare the child to enter school on par with their peers. But there's a research study that's been done by Koppel in 1995, and it was actually entitled The Fade Out Effect. And these are the results of this study. The study indicated that while students may not show IQ gain, they did show that they enjoyed school far more, that they had greater school commitment than their non-Head Start counterparts, meaning those children who were in like environments, in like poverty situations, that At age 15, they placed higher value on schooling and maintained aspirations toward college. They were more willing to talk with their parents. They spent more time on their homework. And I found this an astounding piece in the research, that they rated themselves higher on their ability to be successful regarding school. And so when I read this research, and there's other research that I could cite too, related to those kinds of effects for children that are sustained, that we don't often measure. Those aren't the kinds of things that we measure. And our goal in Head Start, as I said, is to prepare them to enter school ready and to sustain at least on par with their peers. And research supports that that does happen. Research also indicates that it's not enough to take very poor children and have them in an outstanding early childhood environment that addresses the issues, the at-risk factors with poverty, and then not maintain addressing those issues when they enter a public school system. And that it is critical that it's a public school system that we try to maintain the relationship with the parent, and that we try to maintain the growth that has occurred early. We can't expect that to sustain itself without support from other systems when those families move in. So that's a part of work that maybe we can encourage more with our own school systems, and we do talk about that in terms of children that do enter our schools from the Head Start family. So there's quite a body of research that will support, and I can give you all of those. I can give you a bibliography. I don't know how much time you have to read that and how much you want, but I do want you to know that there is a body of research that will support the programs that we are working on. And if you have any other questions, I would be pleased to answer them.
Mr. Chair, I might suggest you send that to Representative Schrader.
I can do that, Representative.
He's the only one up here that can read.
Send it to all of us.
Yeah.
Yes, I will do that. I will do that. I have the research package. I will put it together and do that for you.
Good, thank you. On the back page.
Yes, I will explain that. The very last page is a map of all of the counties in Oregon, and that shows you where all the Head Start programs are. The numbers that you see on those maps refer to the number on the side margin, and it actually just identifies the name of the program. So if you look at number 5, you would see that in Clatsop and Columbia County, it's Columbia Pacific Head Start that is responsible for that. So this definitely gives you a picture that Head Start is everywhere across the state of Oregon, and we have wonderful, dedicated staff working for these children.
And when you say state and federal, you don't mean some are state and some are federal.
No,
we have state and federal funding.
Chair Hartung, you're absolutely right. Okay. It's a combination.
Questions about the matter? No. Thank you very much,
Chair. Sometimes I think, as we think about priorities just overall in the state funding, that we should have funded this program 100% a long time ago.
Exactly.
Just in terms of what is a key priority.
Yeah, and you know, I must say, when I first started here 40 years ago, I wasn't even, of course, so much of that was being done at the local school district. They didn't look to the department or to the legislature, but now that we are the funders of it, why, we certainly should invest in it. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Chair Hartung. And I have one other report that I need to make for you. Sure. This will be very brief.
Go ahead.
You have it in a blue folder, and it's the Together for Children report. This is our Parent as Teacher program, and this will be very brief. This is a reduction. This was in our reduction package for the Department of Education, but we're also required to give a report on this program by Oregon statute. And what I'd like to highlight for you is the number of families that we did serve with this program in the last biennium. It's on page 1 of the report. 748 families were served. It's in a blue folder. And the cover looks like this. Thank you. The parents that we served, 917. A little bit on the family data there. You can see a large number of the families that we served were single parent families. that we served families had more than one risk factor, and in order to be a participant in this program, you had to be a family identified at risk. And I should have started with where these programs are. I'm sorry. Just for a reminder, we had three Together for Children programs or Parent as Teacher programs. They were in Jackson County, Lane County, and Deschutes, Crook, Jefferson counties. These programs have been in existence for the same number of years that Head Start has been in existence. They were funded originally with the intent that the monies would continue to grow and that the program would grow across the state and it would become Oregon's parent as teacher program, much like the Missouri model. We never ever found funding to expand the program. I think the dollars went to Head Start and this program was not expanded. And so the funds now have been extracted from the Department of Education budget. I've highlighted for you some of the outcomes that these programs have reported to us that they've seen because of the results of their work, improved parenting. They've seen that parents have become self-sufficient and able to co-facilitate their own groups. They've been able to learn how to access the community resources that they need. And then the most important piece of the work that has happened across these three counties is that these programs have been closely integrated with multiple service providers for other services within the county itself. And then on the back page, what I highlighted for you is what the counties reported to me as the impact of the funding loss that they will experience. I've mentioned that it's a part of an integrated system of services in every county, and the counties are feeling that this is a fiscal loss to their overall delivery system. And then all of the areas that were funded for Together for Children told me it was the most intensive long-term parenting program offered within their counties and their communities, and that for all of these communities, the services were utilized as a placement site where those families who were required to take parenting classes, they either could have been incarcerated parents or parents on probation or some reason like this, and they believe they will lose those services at least as they're currently delivered. And then all of the programs said that they provided critical services for teen parents and saw that as a major loss within their community. So this is just information for you in terms of the budget reduction package.
I see that the young children ages birth through 8 years, will some of the 0 to 3, will they automatically fall into under Healthy Start programs then?
If they volunteer, Chair Hartung, to be a participant in Healthy Start, yes, this also was a voluntary program. And it will depend on the county plan for those families, yes.
But when was this initiated?
This was initiated in 1987, and the first program started, I believe, in 1988.
And it was, when it started, it was in the counties you have listed, the six, five counties?
Chair Hartung, that is correct.
It hasn't been expanded.
It has not been expanded.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I understand correctly that it is being eliminated in those three counties? It's not in the current proposed budget?
Chair Hartung and Representative Hobson, that's correct. It is not in the proposed budget.
It's in five counties.
It's in five counties, right.
Oh, I meant three.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
If I could just clarify. If I could just clarify.
You could just speak.
I could speak. Members of the subcommittee, that funding has been taken out of the department's budget that transferred over to the governor's children's plan.
Oh. Oh.
And I don't know if they have any updates on this, but or not that funding in the children's plan would continue to fund these programs, or if there's some other potential or some other use for the fund.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to clarify that it's not actually a reduction in the overall budget. It's a movement of funds.
In fact, it has the potential of covering all 36 counties, not just five counties. Is that if the governor's children's plan is initiated? Is that what I'm going to say?
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of hesitant to speak about the children's plan because that's not my area, but this was moved over into funding for that plan.
Okay.
So. potentially, I suppose it could reach all 36 counties.
Okay. Is that an extension of the program or a reallocation of funds into other programs?
Chair Hartung and Senator Troll, my understanding is that it will be a reallocation of the funds, and that within those local counties, when they do their county plan, they can request funds to continue the programs within the overall county plan. And they could, if it meets the goals of everyone in the county, they could still receive funds to do that. But it's a reallocation, a redirection of the dollars. Absolutely right. It's just not within our budget.
Do the ESDs run these programs, or is the local school districts, or where's the coordination countywide? Because our school districts obviously aren't countywide.
Chair Hartung, the program in Medford is run by Community Works, which is a community action organization. The program in Lane County is run by Birth to Three, which is a parenting and other community works with a relief nursery. And the program in Deschutes, Jackson, what are those three counties? You know those three?
Central Oregon,
right. They are with the Central Oregon Community College, has the grant for that program. So they are not run by ESDs or school districts.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay.
Thank you.
Chris, or who's next? Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Anita. Mr. Chair, I'd like to bring our Director of Child Nutrition Services, Dr. Joyce Daugherty, who will talk about our nutritional programs and what they do to help our children and adults across the state. Joyce?
Mr. Chair and members of the Education Subcommittee, for the record, my name is Joyce Daugherty, and I am the Director of the Child Nutrition Programs coordinated by the Department of Education. The Department of Education administers the United States Department of Agricultural Nutrition Programs, the National School Lunch, School Breakfast, Child and Adult Care Food Program, the Summer Food Service Program, Special Milk, and Food Distribution and Commodities. These programs provide cash reimbursement and donated food assistance to public and private schools, residential child care centers, and child and adult care programs. They assist in serving low-cost, nutritious meals to children and developmentally disabled adults, regardless of economic status. All children are able to participate. The National School Lunch Program is our largest program. Three reimbursement categories exist in the schools: paid meals, reduced price meals, and free meals. In a household of four, if the annual income is between $22,000 and $32,000, children are eligible for reduced meals. In a household of four, if the annual income is less than $22,000, children are eligible for free meals. For example, in Multnomah County at Ockley Green, 78% of the children are eligible for free meals. In Lincoln Elementary School in Benton County, 75% of the children are eligible for free meals. In federal fiscal year 2000, the child nutrition programs in Oregon supported Oregon families with $101 million in meals reimbursement and commodity foods. In addition to meal reimbursement, the number of students determined eligible for free or reduced price meals in schools based child nutrition programs are used in calculating Title I, U-Rate, and state school funding.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So you just can't imagine how valuable this program is.
Yeah, true.
And kids, they can't learn unless they're fed well enough so they're not hungry. I mean, this program does a great job. It's federal monies mostly, but we sure appreciate the state running it and what it does.
Chair, finish. Oh, thank you.
Yes, Dr. Daugherty, do you feel that the program is run as best it can be in terms of covering all children possible? You're efficient and effective and all that?
We are efficient and effective, but we could be serving more children.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, do most states have similar programs? I see it's a very large dollar number that we get, I don't sit here now, but 130, 40 million, something like that?
Mr. Chair, $101 million are brought into the state of Oregon through our programs. And all states and territories have a child nutrition program. They vary in terms of where they're placed in the state.
Okay.
Some are in the Department of Education, some are in the Department of Agriculture, some are in the Department of Health and Human Services.
Is all of this, you know, it really disturbs me when you see the figures that there's more poverty amongst children or there's more hungry children in this state than many states. Do they take into, whoever puts, calculates that figure, do they take into consideration that these children, maybe they don't get properly fed at home, but they have the opportunity at school?
Mr. Chair, the studies that you're referring to show that Oregon is the number one state in the nation in terms of hunger.
Yes.
And that was a study conducted by Tufts University. So what they're looking at income, and they're looking at employment, and they're looking at, they provide a questionnaire that's 18 questions. And based on that questionnaire, they determine the hunger capacity of children and families within each of the states in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, Oregon ranks number one in terms of hunger.
Amazing. I don't get it. But who do I go to get it?
Well, one of the things is, you know, that all those families that are earning less than $12,000 a year, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's just awfully hard to stretch that between mm-hmm. housing and food and clothes and cars and whatever else they need.
So do we have proportionally more of those families than in the other 49 states?
Mr. Chair,
I wouldn't think so.
I think a couple of things that they have shown is that when you look at housing costs and when you look at energy costs, those are pretty fixed incomes, and housing costs are high in Oregon compared to some of the other states. Flexibility in terms of food dollars is where there's very little discretionary dollars with food. And so a lot of our families are choosing to pay rent and to stay warm, and then they have less dollars for food.
Superintendent of Tillamook, well, you're 2,200 students. Do you think you had a lot of students that were hunger was a big part of their life?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is some truth to that. We even had kids living in cars that the Department of Forestry would discover up roads, even in inclement weather. One of the nice things about this program, and we expanded it as have many districts, to include a summer program in one school, and then the breakfast program, which I have to tell you, back in the old days, I thought, good night, you know, we're feeding them already at noon. But the breakfast program is relatively simple, number one, cold cereal or sticky rolls or whatever that the cooks put up there, and the kids come in, they, you know how kids eat. It takes them. We were a little worried about the timing issue. That was not a problem. 30 seconds and they've missed it, you know, and are out of there. But I think it has a profound effect, both, I think the studies have shown academically, but also in the culture of the school, and I envision smiley faces of kids who've eaten, which is basic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good program.
Mm-hmm. Kate, I see you there. Would you please get together with Stan and, you know, come back to us with some kind of idea so we get away from being number one for hungry children in this country? I just can't believe it. I'd like to hear your Stan's comments at your earliest convenience.
Thank you. One of the things, Senator, is that these programs are basically based in the schools, and the schools
yeah.
are not open all the time.
Yeah.
That's the thing. On weekends, they're not open. And
summer.
During the summer, and holidays, and so forth. And so people can be hungry, those times.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Troll, we have requested a waiver with our summer food service program to make it easier for the schools to be open and to run the summer food service program, because it is a program that is free to all children, but it is a difficult program to run.
Dr. Doherty, your opinion, please, on the report. You said it was Tusk University, did that?
University.
Well, where is that located?
It's in Washington, D.C.
Tusk.
I'm sorry, it's in Boston. And it is a research institution, and they worked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture
okay.
in looking at hunger throughout the country. And as I said earlier, they have a 18-question validated survey that is a good indicator, an excellent indicator in terms of hunger and food insecurity.
But, and you've read the complete report, I'll bet.
And it's a report, a survey that is conducted every 2 or 3 years.
Yeah. Okay, before Stan and Kate come back here, please consult with them and tell them what you think about the report, too, because I think that is really something that we need to address. This legislature, Department of Education, is certainly the best position to address that. So we'd really appreciate that kind of attention. Thank you. Nice report. Nice to meet you. I don't think you've ever been before.
This is my first time.
Oh, good. You did very well.
Thank you, Chair.
Where did you come from?
I'm born and raised in Portland.
Really?
Most recently from Washington State, the Department of Health.
Washington State University?
No, Washington State.
State of.
Washington State Department of Health.
Department of Health.
That's correct.
Did you go to Jefferson High School?
I did.
Hey, Representative Jackie Winters and I went to Jefferson. Did you go to Oakley Green?
No, I didn't.
Oh, darn.
Mr. Chair, did she know you did?
How would she know that? Well, I feel really fortunate that we... how did you land this job? Were you recruited or did you apply? Or
combination of both, Mr. Chair. I found out about the job and I applied.
Well, that's wonderful. Where did you get your doctorate?
At Oregon State.
Yay. Wow. Cliff and I are beavers. And so, I mean, if you went to Jefferson High School and Oregon State, well, I know you are good.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else said? Or?
Yes, one more report.
Sure.
Thank you, Joyce. I'd like to bring Mr. Chair, Dr. Richard Latour, who is our Director of Federal Programs in the Office of Service. Dr. Latour has extensive experience in several federal programs, and we'll talk about some of the implications of reauthorization. Also, there are certain models of student size reduction programs that have helped schools. And again, using some of our federal resources that have helped general fund or mainstream classrooms cut down on class size, teacher-student ratios. We've looked at combining some of our resources, and again, we've done a real good job. As you can see, our staff is really on top of things as far as whatever the regulations might be, what the models are, but we're there helping schools do a better job, and I'll turn it over to Rick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My primary purpose is to make myself available for questions on federal programs. As Merced indicated, I administer or direct approximately 13 federal programs for the Department of Education. And I would want to make myself available to have you ask me questions about those. While you're thinking about what questions you might want to ask me, I thought I would highlight three programs in particular. Two of them I'd like to highlight because they were relatively new programs during the last legislative session. There was some discussion on them. I want to give you an update on those. And one of them, which I'm happy to say, was on my list, is to talk about our homeless program. So,
excuse me, Rick, are you in the book here somewhere? Or are you...
Am I in
the
book? I don't know whether I'm in the book or
the
not.
The Bible? Or are you just winging it?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm not winging it.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no handout, but actually we're listed here under there's several different programs.
What page is that?
That's 55.
Well, okay, thank you. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first program I'd like to talk very briefly about is our comprehensive school reform demonstration grant. As indicated, this is a demonstration project. We will be receiving approximately $1.7 million from the federal government next year. We anticipate that being about $3 million over the biennium. This program is designed to do two things. One is designed to identify a select number of schools that are relatively low performing related to the state standards and to provide them with two kinds of assistance. One is direct assistance in the form of bodies, people who go in and work with the schools and help them through a process of planning and implementation. The other is to provide them with resources primarily to be used to adopt or bring into the school externally research-based proven practices or programs. We are entering our third.
Senator Tropes.
This money will flow to those schools through your organization, with you administering it, or is it given in a grant to those schools and then they hire people to come in to do those things? How does it work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, for the most part, what we do is we administer the program and they select programs that meet their needs, and they are external consultants, and they use the funding to pay for those external consultants.
So they get them, you give them the money then, and they provide. So you're not providing people who go in.
Actually, we do both. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, we do both through our Distinguished Educator Program. That's a federal term. They don't like it, and we're not too fond of it either. But it's we've managed to bring teachers and administrators from local districts into job rotations. They stay with us from anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And what they we select them based on their demonstrated success in working with highly challenged schools, primarily serving children who may be from ethnic, linguistically, or culturally diverse backgrounds, or who come from high poverty backgrounds. We then are able to put them in contact with these funded schools, and that's the human resource we provide. And then beyond that, they can use the funding, which is averaging about $75,000 per year for a period of up to 3 years, so they can receive about $200,000 to $225,000 over a three-year period.
Single school.
Single school.
Wow.
And they can use that to purchase those kinds of things that are most necessary to improve schools: professional development, external resources, assistance.
Well, that's really good federal help. That makes sense.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The second program I would like to spend a little bit of time talking to you about is a program that was new during the last legislative session, just gearing up, and that was the Class Size Reduction Initiative. The Class Size Reduction Initiative was a pilot program 2 years ago. We are entering the third year. Oregon is slated to receive $15.6 million this year to distribute to schools. That funding goes to all school districts. It is distributed on a formula basis, with 80% of the funds based on poverty counts, of U.S. Census poverty counts, and 20% based on attendance, school attendance. It focuses primarily on K-3 and has a goal of reducing the class size to 1 to 18, one instructional teacher to every 18 students. Currently, this program has resulted in 300 new teachers in Oregon schools. And as we enter the third year, we anticipate that with the increase in funding we're getting, which is about 24%, that we will add an additional 75 teachers, so approximately 375 new teachers in the classroom next year.
Are you having any problem finding qualified teachers?
Mr. Chair, they are. Some districts do, in fact, have more trouble finding qualified teachers than others. Because the focus is primarily on the primary grades, it isn't quite as challenging as has been defined specific teachers such as math, science, and language arts in the high school.
Are these funds just for the public schools?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, yes.
Are they for charter public schools?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, because charter schools in Oregon are considered part of the school district, they are in fact eligible for the funding as well.
If we had done it differently and made them more private schools, they would not be eligible?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, that's correct. In most states, they are not eligible.
Is there any flexibility? Let's see. Now, we're talking about federal funds, Title VI.
Actually, we're talking about class size reduction funding, which is under Title VI. There's also innovative programs under Title VI. It's a little confusing.
Is there enough flexibility, for instance, Senator Courtney wants, you know, smaller school sizes? Is there an opportunity to use some of these funds? Probably not, since this is just for grades 1 through 3. We couldn't use that to reduce the size of schools, separate schools.
Senator Hartung, the funding is specifically earmarked to reduce class size by the hiring of certified teachers.
I've done it. Now, this is part. Was that President Clinton's program to hire 100,000 new teachers?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. And it was perceived, quite frankly, to be a short-term program. It was perceived that it would not. However, during the election, both candidates spoke highly of the program, and it is in President Bush's package.
Okay. The same kind of program?
Very much the same program.
Okay. Thank you.
Finally, I'd like to take just a few moments to talk to you about our homeless education program. Generally, this is not a program that gets very much highlighting. It's a relatively small program. It's called the McKinney Homeless Grant.
Who is Stuart B. McKinney?
I wish I could tell you, Senator. I believe he's an ex-senator. The McKinney grants, as you can see, are relatively small amounts of funding, about $281,000. As you heard in the earlier reports from Dr. Doherty, Oregon faces some significant challenges in meeting the needs of all of our children, particularly those children who are living in extreme poverty, and extreme poverty often translates into both high mobility and sometimes into homelessness. In this case, what we've done is I wanted to highlight this program because I wanted to talk about the flexibility that we have tried to build and the braiding that Superintendent Flores talked about in his opening remarks. Braiding is a very good term. Braid, if we think of it in the terms of a rope, is taking separate strands and entwining them in a thoughtful and patterned way to create a stronger ability to pull a heavy load in one direction. And in doing that with homeless children, what we found is that we were falling far short using these limited funds in serving the homeless needs in the state. So one of the things that we did, I'll give you a small bit of history. I came to this program, was honored to receive this position at the same time that this bill was reauthorized in 1995. At the time I inherited the program, we had a binder bigger than your blue binder in front of you of regulations associated with Title I. We eliminated all but two. One of those was the supplanting one, which we're not allowed to do. The other that we maintained was a unique Oregon program, which required local school districts, if they had a certain shelter count each year, to set aside funding for the service of homeless children out of Title I funding. That program has, in fact, become a national model for how you can take two funding sources and use them to support one group of children. And it has been, in fact, successful enough that what we are finding is that districts are now setting aside even some of their general fund dollars in an effort to continue to provide those services. With that, those are the three programs that I appreciate your indulgence in having me highlight. I'm here to answer questions on any of the other programs or these programs.
Certainly, Senator Cho. What kind of services do we provide for the homeless?
Senator Hartung, Senator Cho, the primary service that we're finding and recommending is a home and school liaison who helps the school identify where the homeless children are. There have been cases where people don't believe that homelessness exists because they don't see children on the street, as it were, or sleeping in doorways. Homelessness can be defined in many ways, and children are disadvantaged by those factors. For example, three families living in the same apartment disadvantages children because they have no privacy, they have no place to, often they're not sleeping well, they may not have the access to basic school supplies. They also may find themselves in a situation where they have no place to do their homework. So among the things that we do is we provide liaison for identifying. Another major area that we'd like to put encourage schools to do is what we call homeschool transportation. Often what has happened in the past is that homeless children lost access to their home school by moving out of the school residency area. In large districts like Portland, they have a program in which they literally can bus children from the shelter, which may be out of their residence area, back to their school of origin, creating a continuity of school opportunity, security for that child. And those are the kinds of programs that we've – those are two examples.
Rick, you are in luck. Our head questioner just arrived.
The inquisitor, is that what you meant to say?
Yes. You're on.
Just a couple questions. I was wondering about the linkage between the comprehensive school reform demonstration grants and our existing education reform program here in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, we have made significant efforts starting in 1995 to ensure that everything that we do within federal programs lines up with what the state's reform efforts are. Probably the major demonstration of that has been that previous to 1995, children who were served by federal programs were often held to a different standard. They were assessed in different ways. And that resulted often in a less than full set of expectations for children because they came from poverty, because they had certain disadvantaging factors. In other words, we made excuses for why these children couldn't perform. What we've done within federal programs has said that as the state has undertaken its reform efforts, as it has adopted standards, as it has developed state assessments, we've said to schools that if you receive federal funds, those federal funds must, your accountability related to continuing to receive those federal funds means that your students have to perform to that state standards as measured by the same state assessment. And to the degree, we've also provided them with some flexibility. Going with that accountability is a great deal more flexibility. We've eliminated a lot of the house rules, as it were. We've said if you can read the law, quite frankly, Mr. Chair and Representative Schrader, people don't tend to think of federal programs and innovation in the same thought. They're kind of an oxymoron, but a lot of our work over the last 4 years has been, in fact, to do exactly that. We've encouraged school districts to come to us with ideas that meet their local needs and the changing demographics of their schools. If I might, I'll tell you a brief story. A call that was very typical when I first got to the office would have been one that went like this. I had a school principal call me and said, excuse me, I was wondering if you would approve the allowance of me purchasing hockey equipment with Title I money, which is money for disadvantaged students, if only the Title I kids played with it and we read about hockey. Can I buy equipment? Previous to 1995, we would have answered that question, yes or no, and they would have either gone back to their athletic director and said, yes, they'll let you, or no, they won't, based on that answer. What we now answer in those situations is, first, do you have all the resources you need to make sure your kids are meeting standard? And they often will say no. And we'll say, is the purchase of hockey equipment the single best thing you can think of in order to assist your students in reaching standards? If the answer is yes, and that is in fact the district's best assessment, because I can think of situations in which that might be true, we say the law is silent on hockey equipment, bless you, and go forth. If the answer is no, then we use that opportunity to discuss with them things that they may want to do to address the needs. But they can use the federal funding in much, much more broad ways, and the state doesn't dictate that as much as it used to.
Well, that's very helpful. Thank you. Do the school districts contact your office directly, or do they go through the other offices that are dealing with the educational reform, SIM, and CAM type of curriculum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, they will do both. They work with both offices, and in fact, as we've begun to work with our the program I talked about, the Comprehensive School Reform Demonstration Grants, we've done that in conjunction with the Office of Curriculum Instruction and Field Services, where most of the SIM and CAM work is being done, to ensure that what we do is we provide services. We've identified, for example, as we identify schools that may need assistance, we look to coordinate that so that we don't have an overlap where one school is getting a wealth of resources and another getting none.
Okay. Well,
on the class size reduction, it'd be interesting to get a list of those districts that qualify, given the criteria.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, all districts qualify. All districts receive a grant. The proportion of grant is obviously tied to primarily the size of the school district.
I see. Thank you.
Size of the school district or the number of children in grades 1 to 3?
Actually, not, Mr. Chair, not grades 1 to 3. The actual amount going to the district is based on two factors, primarily. 80% of the formula is based on the number of poverty children within the district as a whole, independent of grade level. 20% is based on the enrollment of the district, independent of grade level. However, the law targets K-3 as the primary areas for class size reduction.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Well,
yes, Representative Schrader. Oh, go ahead, okay. Senator Trump.
My question sort of relates to that. In small schools where you just don't have very large class sizes, do they get any money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trump, yes, in fact, they do get money. In the first year of the allocation, for example, Harney County as a county, the entire county got $18,000. The federal government, in its wisdom, said that what they should do is create a consortium, hire whatever teacher they could with $18,000 and have them travel around Harney County. We suggested to the federal government that was not a reasonable way to deal with that. and suggested, in fact, that a waiver for that county or for districts that receive very small grants would be that they could use the funding for other purposes, including professional development for existing staff. In the new guidance that's coming with this grant, in fact, that is an option. For districts that receive less than $10,000, they may use all of the funding if they wish. They still have an option to hire teachers, but they can use all of the funding for professional development. Oh. And many do take advantage of that.
Representative Freeman.
Speaking of flexibility, it's come to our attention in the state of Oregon that there may be additional federal dollars coming to the state of Oregon above what was anticipated in the governor's recommended budget, significant dollars. And I was interested if you had an accurate accounting of what we might anticipate and what programs that are linked to, or indeed how much flexibility do we have with additional dollars?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I do not have any projections of figures beyond the $36 million that we're projecting, but how that will break down, the reauthorization debates are in fact still going on. They are talking about taking approximately 30 education programs and putting them under seven large headings. Title I would remain one of those. The other programs are around improving teacher quality and right. Rather large educational areas.
We have on page 56 the grant and aid programs, the federal funds that we didn't know about early enough to be in the governor's program. There's $36 million, and there's in the book here somewhere there's identified more, but here's okay, the great. Many programs.
Most of those come with a no supplanting clause.
That's what I was getting at.
In other words, we can't pull our general fund money out and substitute that. It has to be for these types of programs, or if we could, if we got 100% funding of Head Start, we could use whatever it takes for the 40 we've funded for 60%. Isn't that right, or do they think of it that way?
Mr. Chair, I think I could answer that. Okay. If the federal government increased the Head Start funds, we could use that to serve the 60% target. That could be a...
Serve the 60% target, mm-hmm. Even though we had targeted that with our existing funds?
Mr. Chair, there is no supplanting or non-supplanting requirement with a Head Start.
I can just add
But
they have new requirements for their additional money, remember? And we're not sure that we can really qualify that many kids and to meet those requirements.
Follow up on
sure.
I guess I would like... this is very good information. I would like to see... among the, if this is the total that you know so far, I'm led to believe there's more money coming than the $36 million, almost double that, actually more than double that. Yeah. So I'd be interested in knowing if it's going to be the same, anticipated by your department to be the same programs that are listed on page 56, and it would be helpful to know which ones allow supplanting and which ones don't, so that if we have some available money, we can make best use of it.
Mr. Chair, in addition to what's on page 56, because this is just the Office of Student Services,
okay.
Primarily the compensatory education programs that Rick Latour has been mentioning, also on page 67, I want to point out the Special Education Office is expecting a large increase, and we have estimated there a little over $51
million. Wow, there we go.
We'll be covering that early next week.
Right. That's, I guess, what I was thinking.
Would that go into pre-K?
Mr. Chair, Senator Troa, I don't believe so. There's a category for a nice try. But
never hurts to ask. Okay. What else?
I think that concludes our presentation for today with the reminder that I think we're scheduled for a field trip to the School for the Blind and Deaf on Monday.
That's right.
We have transportation at the front of the steps on the north side at 1 o'clock.
And are you clear, Sue, who's going and not?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And I would just add... we could just meet here at 1 o'clock and then we'll...
Okay. We're going to do both schools? Is that
yes,
it?
We have a trip planned that will get you in touch with children at both schools, and en route we will be giving you commentary about the school. No wasted
good.
Time.
Very good.
Good. Rick, did you go to Jefferson High School by any chance?
Mr. Chair, no, but we do provide a significant matter of funding to Ockley Green, and and I appreciate, Mr. Chair,
we'll
you not asking me where I got my doctorate.
Any other business? If not, we adjourn. All right.